The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, Democrats put on a display before America.
Gentleman does not have the time.
I don't want the time. I want the Attorney General to be able to have enough time to respond to accusations and questions asked him, and you guys not cut him off.
What you want is irrelevant, but irrelevant are the rules.
Violence continues in Portland.
Democrat politicians are downplaying this.
And America is in the crosshairs at home.
The idea of systemic and overarching type of racism is completely and utterly false.
And abroad.
China is a massive bully on the world stage.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And please follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow the program as well at Town Hall Review. We'll begin in the nation's capital. The United States Attorney General William Barr sat before the House Judiciary Committee earlier this week and faced an ambush by Democratic lawmakers. But Barr is a seasoned veteran of partisan politics. He came prepared for the antics. They harassed him, refused to let him answer their own questions, even told him he couldn't take a 5-minute restroom break. It was a show they put on for the media, trusting the media would edit the proceedings to look like the ambush worked. For the viewers who tuned in live, it was a clown show. For those who listen to my radio show and other outlets that are fair, it made the Democrat look like children. If you want Democrats to run the country, this was a good look inside the insanity of their worldview. Attack your opponents. Don't let them speak. Don't even give them common courtesies. What we have been exposed to on college campuses has now become the pattern of Democrats all across the country. The day after the clown show, I examined a bit of their theater on the Hugh Hewitt Show. But let's go to the hearing.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just real quick. I don't think we've ever had a hearing where the witness wasn't allowed to respond to points made, questions asked, and attacks made. Not just in this committee, but every committee I've been on.
Particularly
when you think about the fact we got the Attorney General of the United States here.
Gentleman does not have the time.
I don't want the time. I want the Attorney General to be able to have enough time to respond to accusations and questions asked him, and you guys not cut him off.
What you want is irrelevant, but irrelevant are the rules.
Irrelevant. That's it. They just were up to do speeches yesterday. They didn't have any questions for Barr, really. You see, I'm just letting the Democrats talk. Here's more Jerry Nadler talking about the protesters. Cut number 12.
A neutral criteria.
But you can't tell me whether you discussed.
No, I'm not going to discuss what I discussed with the
president. Can you commit today that the department will not use federal law enforcement as a prop in the president's reelection campaign?
We are not using
federal law enforcement. I just want to close with this thought. You really can't hide behind legal fictions this time, Mr. Barr. It's all out in the open, where the people can see what you are doing for themselves. The president wants footage for his campaign ads, and you appear to be serving it up to him as ordered. In most of these cities, the protests had begun to wind down before you marched in and confronted the protesters. And the protesters aren't mobs. They are mothers and veterans and mayors. In this moment, real leadership would entail de-escalation, collaboration, and looking for ways to peaceably resolve our differences. Instead, you use pepper spray and truncheons on American citizens. You did it here in Washington. You did it at Lafayette Square. You expanded to Portland. And now you are projecting fear and violence nationwide in pursuit of obvious political objectives. Shame on you, Mr. Barr.
Can I just say, Mr.
Shame on you.
Can I just
My
say,
time has expired. For what purpose does Mr. Jordan see recognition?
No, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Excuse me.
Could I just
what
have a moment?
My time has expired.
You get what they're doing? He did more of it. Cut number 13. He's trying to drink coffee at this point. Natalie.
I would remind Mr. Jordan, Mr. Biggs, and Mr. Johnson to stop violating the rules of the committee, to stop violating the safety of the members of the committee, to stop holding themselves out as not caring by refusing to wear their masks.
Can we get the picture?
Is it permissible to drink a sip of coffee?
It is not permissible.
Not to drink.
We can't drink coffee in the room.
Now, get ready to ask questions. And I will.
Mr. Gates is ready.
No. He went.
He went, and that's why I took off my mask, Mr. Chairman.
I'm going to go.
Nadler's confused, and then he goes grandstanding.
See, I was surprised. I just asked if you'd done that. So as part of those conversations with the president or his people about the reelection campaign, have you ever discussed the current or future deployment of federal law enforcement?
In connection with what?
In connection with what you just said, in connection with your discussions with the president or with other people around him of his reelection campaign, have you discussed the current or future deployment of federal law enforcement?
Well, as I say, I'm not going to get into my discussions with the president, but I've made it clear that I would like to pick the cities based on law enforcement need and based on neutral criteria.
But you can't tell me whether you discussed...
No, I'm not going to discuss what I discussed with the president.
Can you commit today that the department will not use federal law enforcement as a prop in the president's reelection campaign?
We are not using federal
law enforcement. I just want to close with this thought.
I understand it's not making any sense. This is the Democrats yesterday. They want to run the country with Joe Biden. Madeline Dean's another one, cut number 27.
An ideal chemical dispensing system. So while you, in a quote, said it's not chemical, you today confirm it is chemical, and you're aware of your department's policy, are you not?
What policy?
The one I've just provided to you.
What does it say? What's the policy?
Well, I showed it to you. Finally, whether or not you authorized it at the time, perhaps you weren't listening.
I didn't see the policy. What was the policy
clearly
in there?
You weren't listening. Fine. Whether or not you authorized the use of pepper balls.
He's laughing at her.
He's laughing at her
because Barr is sitting there. He's just laughing at these Democrats. They're so doggone dumb. Bill Barr needs to go to the bathroom.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, could we take a five-minute break?
Ms. Dean is recognized.
Could we take a five-minute break, Mr. Chairman?
No.
That's a common courtesy, Ms.
Dean is
Chairman, of every witness.
You're real classy. Oh,
okay. After this, if you still want, we'll have a break.
No, he wants a break now.
You want it now?
And you just mentioned
committee,
rudeness.
Committee
I think we're
stand,
seeing it on display. Let's let the Attorney General have a break.
While protesting and riots spread across the country, no city has experienced the consistency of them as Portland, Oregon. The home of Antifa, a violent far-left organization, the city of Portland continues to burn night after night. Even the rioters of Seattle look upon the city of Portland with envy. A year ago, Antifa attacked a journalist and nearly killed him. But that didn't stop the journalist Andy Ngo from heading back to the streets of Portland to continue covering the unrest. He was on with my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
I read a piece in the Oregonian, and it was about the riots and the effect on business. And this is the gist of the long article in the Oregonian this weekend that as I understood it, basically that it's exaggerated how much has happened because it's only dangerous at night and in a very small area of Portland, and only a few hundred people are involved. That's what I picked up from the Oregonian. Was my pickup accurate? And B, if it was, is the Oregonian accurate?
The Oregonian is the paper record in Portland. It's our legacy media here. And its history is, it does good work, but as with all major media institutions and publications, the younger people that have come to replace it are of the social justice worldview, and it's reflected more in the journalism. So with that particular story, I'm glad it's talking about some of the economic impacts of the riots. I think the bias of the rioters shows through in that they're trying to minimize what's happening by describing it as a small area downtown and that it's only potentially dangerous at night. I mean, that type of perspective is essentially what normalizes this. I personally do not accept that in any American city should a area of downtown be a literal no-go zone, not just for police, but for drivers or people who have different views. You can't drive there. They have guards essentially standing on the street to block traffic, and it's also to block law enforcement from going inside. And it's a pretty large area. It's a 3x3 block.
So is this Portland's Chaz?
It is, but it's worse in that during the day it goes away. If you work in that area and you work during the day, you can go through the place is a mess, but otherwise you can still access it. I mean, this is in front of the federal courthouse. It's in front of the county courthouse. It's by City Hall. It's a very important area downtown. It's at night that it becomes a no-go zone. So it is like Portland's Chaz, I would say, but it's worse in that the number of people there are more radical, more extreme.
It's hard to imagine more extreme than Chaz, but it's an odd competition. So a final question. There's something I must admit I can't quite wrap my mind around. Does the average citizen of Portland not find this intolerable?
It's hard for me to gauge the views of the majority because the people who are vocal are very hard left. And by hard left, I'm not just talking about liberal or Democrat. I mean far left.
Communist, basically.
I would say extreme in some ways. They support this. They have sympathies not just for socialism and communism and anarchism. They may actually be supportive of it, and some of them are actually in government positions. I think it's quite appalling that congressmen for the area, Errol Blumenauer, actually shared the link for how people could donate to one of the Antifa groups who has been
supplying the congressman.
Yeah, people. Mm-hmm. Yes. He's the one with the bow tie. He went to Congress who was saying that essentially what's happening in Portland is being exaggerated. Democrat politicians are downplaying this because what it reflects on them is that their inability or not having the desire to clamp down on riots in their own cities. And they're blaming it on on DHS, on the Trump administration. But that's bogus because, the surge of additional reinforcements to protect the federal courthouse and other federal property didn't happen in Portland until 5 weeks in. So there were already 5 weeks of daily violent protests that were happening before reinforcements came. So they're just using it now as a convenient excuse to put the blame elsewhere.
Coming up,
Democrat politicians are downplaying this.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Speaking at the Nixon Library a little over a week ago, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo urged the world to change the way it does business with China. Taking a page from Ronald Reagan's trust but verify view of the Soviet Union, Pompeo said, distrust and verify when it comes to communist China. Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher joined me on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Since I've got China Mike Gallagher, I got to talk to you about the Secretary of State's speech. What did you make of the Pompeo speech on China?
I thought it was an excellent speech, and I really think when you consider it as part of the speeches that Robert gave, the speech that FBI Director Wray gave, and the speech that Attorney General Barr gave, I mean, this, I can't think of a parallel in recent history where you have all the major national security voices in an administration on a single theme, touching on different elements of that theme, but pushing coercion and the deception of the Chinese Communist Party, but really making an affirmative case for the free world and for American values. So I really commend Secretary Pompeo for it. I thought he chose a great venue for it as well. And I thought the Q&A that you led after was very revealing. And so very well done by both you and Secretary Pompeo.
You know, the actual sequence of speeches begins with Vice President Pence giving two speeches on China last year. I wouldn't be surprised if the president follows up with this. And this goes to my point, Mike Gallagher. I think President Trump's number one accomplishment is to clarify the relationship with the Chinese Communist Party and to infuse America with conviction that it must oppose their agenda at every turn. I think that's number one, even ahead of judges. What do you think?
I agree with that 100%. I mean, this is the biggest shift in U.S. grand strategy since the end of the Cold War. And the Trump administration deserves enormous credit for it. I suspect when the history of the new Cold War is written, we will get a lot of insight into all the documents that preceded Vice President Pence's exceptional speech at the Hudson Institute, which is when you had commentators like Walter Russell Mead and Neil Ferguson start to talk openly about, are we in a Cold War II right now? It really is remarkable. And I think evidence that this is going to endure beyond the Trump administration, almost regardless of who wins in November, can be found in the fact that at times now Biden is trying to walk away from his previous accommodationist views on China, some of the nice things he said about General Secretary Xi, and in some cases trying to run to the right of Trump on China and attack Trump on China. So when your opponents are doing something like that, you know you're on to something. And I think that reflects the fact that the American people, by and large, support this shift. They may not be talking in barrooms about, you know, how China's accession to the WTO was a disaster for Midwestern manufacturing, though it was. But they do have a sense that we are starting, or we are at the early stages of a struggle between two really competing systems and ideologies. Or if nothing else, they have a sense that China is a massive bully on the world stage, and the Chinese Communist Party is forcing everybody, whether it's LeBron James or Hollywood executives or hedge fund managers, to bend the knee and accept Communist Party values as opposed to American values.
The idea that the United States is inherently and systemically racist has divided Americans coast to coast. While much more prevalent within the Democratic Party, it has split some Republicans as well. Peter Kirsten now is an outspoken black conservative serving his third six-year term as a member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Peter discussed this topic with Salem host Bob Franz on AM 1420. The Answer, out of Cleveland.
Systemic racism. The Indians did a little thing. They didn't kneel during the national anthem. What they are doing is kneeling before the national anthem, holding a long black ribbon, which is a tribute to Black Lives Matter and a call to end racism. And, of course, those two things can't really coexist. Black Lives Matter exists as a racist organization looking to perpetuate the divide between the races. So let's talk about systemic racism and what it really means, because, again, this is what you wrote about. The first piece last week that you wrote about, and I was so glad to be able to read this, the systemic racism canard. Let's address that from its title. What is systemic about race? Are there racists in America? Sure. There are racists all around the world, and they come in all colors, by the way. But what is it in these United States that makes it systemic in the mind of those who believe it, Pete?
Well, I cannot speak for how it got into the minds of those who believe it, other than they're just being constantly peppered with it, constantly. Systemic racism, institutional racism.
But what are they saying it is? What are they saying is systemic about it?
What they're saying is that the systems in place, whether it's the criminal justice system, the educational system, are so imbued with racism. They are structured in a way that favors whites, disfavors blacks, and to a lesser extent, Hispanics. They never talk about Asians, of course. But the manner in which it's structured, its systems, tests that may be set up in terms of entry tests or promotional tests or the things that allow you to advance in a particular institution through a certain system are skewed or biased against blacks in profound ways. That includes the criminal justice system also. So almost everything, employment, criminal justice, schools, are innately biased to the disadvantage of blacks. And the argument is, or at least I'm not sure that you hear too many people overtly arguing this, except for example, some of the individuals who promote the 1619 Project, which is one of the greatest scams ever perpetrated, but one of the most dangerous scams ever perpetrated on the American people. But the idea is that America is indelibly stained with racism, that the systems are so skewed that blacks cannot advance and are always at a disadvantage. And as you indicated, it is pretty clear that there are racists in a country of 330 million. There are white racists, black racists, Hispanic racists, there are all kinds of racists. There's no evidence that one group is more racist than another, although there's some polling data that suggests that, you know, there are certain elements that are more racist than others. But nonetheless, the idea of systemic and overarching type of racism is completely and utterly false and has been for quite some time. There was systemic racism in the United States, pretty severe and entrenched in invidious systemic racism for a significant portion of our history. But over the last 50 to 60 years, that's not been the case. And as I say in the piece, if you just take a fair look at the evidence, there is systemic racism. And I go into the reasons for it, but it goes in a direction opposite of that contended by those who are constantly intoning systemic or institutional racism. By that I mean, over the last 50 or 60 years, and I'll just give you a couple of examples, and I think everybody knows this, and as I say in the piece, I think everybody knows this, and everyone understands that the idea of systemic racism against blacks in the main, 99% of it is a complete and utter lie, not just a falsehood, a lie, because people know it's a lie. They can see with their own eyes how, to a large extent, the left has taken any disparity in outcome and equated that with racism. But you can see what's happening here. Look at our educational institutions. In almost every educational setting, but definitely at the collegiate setting, blacks are significantly favored in terms of admissions and also once in the kind of expectations over their white and Asian comparatives.
Coming up.
What was really enabled us to survive was a nuclear family and our Christian values.
A look at black American life from 100 years ago when the Town Hall Review continues with Hugh Hewitt in a moment.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The New York Times created quite a stir with their 1619 Project, which treats that year as the beginning of the United States, a reworking of history that puts slavery at the core of the narrative. While historians across the board have challenged the facts of the 1619 Project, the project still won a Pulitzer. No surprise there, really. And this week, the creator of the project admitted that it is not, in fact, history at all. Salem host Larry Elder turned to Bob Woodson, civil rights leader, community activist, founder of the Woodson Center.
First, tell us what 1619 is, that project, and why is it that it bothers you?
Because 1619 is an attempt on the part of the left to define America in terms of its slave past. And as a consequence, they are saying that because the founders, many of them were slaveholders, and therefore the document of 1776, the Declaration of Independence, is therefore flawed. And they conclude that America is forever, racism is in its DNA, it defines what it is. It's almost a criminal organization, that all whites are privileged and therefore victimizers, and all blacks are victims. In need of compensation, but they offer, and it's revisionist history. But it's really, I think, an attempt on the part of the left to kind of undermine and promote a kind of Marxism that is really frightening. And they're really dumbing down the culture. The left is exploiting America's birth defect of slavery to use that condition as a bludgeon to undermine the principles upon which this nation was built. So we believe since they are using race as a messenger, that we would mobilize primarily black scholars and activists not as a counterforce to that, but not to offer an alternative argument, but to put forth an inspirational and aspirational narrative that refutes and challenges what they do by highlighting how when whites were at their worst, blacks were at their best. When that the biggest gains, like one of our scholars did a study, Larry, of six major plantations at the end of slavery, found that 75% of all slave families had a man and a woman raising children. And for a century, that continued, that even in 1930s to 1940s, when racism was the rule of law, and unemployment during the Depression was 40 and 50% in the black community, we have the highest marriage rate of any group in the country, and that our elderly people could walk unafraid of their grandchildren. And so when we were denied access to hotels, we built our own insurance companies, our own railroads, our own vaudeville theaters with the orchestra pits. All this we did in response to oppression. It wasn't as 1619 says, broadcast that somehow we were, our history is from the plantation, from the slave ships, the plantations, the ghettos, to the welfare.
Bob, what happened to the family? Is it the welfare state?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Larry, the family was strong. What was really enabled us to survive was a nuclear family and our Christian values. And that's why up until 1965, 85% of all black families had a man and a woman raising children. And they talk about mass incarceration. If you look at the turn of the century up until the 1960s, black incarceration rates were about 27 to 30%. And yet, and then when the poverty programs came and we disconnected work from income, and we removed the stigma. When I grew up, man, you never wanted to be on relief.
Mm-hmm. My parents called it on the county, and it was
and it was not
a flattering thing to say.
No, and so they had to remove the stigma of it. They were able to define welfare from social insurance to reparations. So they convinced black folks. Plus, they demonized the nuclear family. They said that the nuclear family is Eurocentric and therefore racist. And they were supported by the women's movement. They was also supported by the Black Power movement. So the black community was targeted because of the Watts riots and also because of the history of slavery and discrimination. Mm-hmm. They and their goal, Cloud and Piven said it, they want to promote income redistribution. And the way you promote income redistribution is bankrupt the existing systems. Their agenda has been in place for 50 years.
To hear the entire conversation between Elder and Bob Woodson, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the attack on our great city.
It would bother me less if these were just stupid people who didn't know of what they spoke. They know exactly what they're talking about.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. We spoke earlier of Antifa's attack on the beautiful city of Portland, Oregon. Then former Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge criticized federal efforts to stop Antifa from attacks on federal buildings. This caught the attention of former Assistant United States Attorney Andrew McCarthy, now a writer for National Review. McCarthy spoke with Salem host Sebastian Gorka.
But Ridge knows better than anyone that here's what he said first before I go on about it. He said that the people in Portland who are reacting to the firebombing of a federal courthouse were the president's personal militia, that the president was treating them as his personal militia.
He knows that it's that they are law enforcement agents, that they are not military. He knows he's saying that in the framework of people like Speaker Pelosi, who is a, you know, an out and out political hack, calling them unidentified stormtroopers. So Ridge knows exactly what he's doing and what he's contributing to. And he knows that this is not a military agency. They are law enforcement agencies that are grouped under the umbrella of a government department. And they are responsible for the protection of personal, of federal property. Right. And the president has a constitutional obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, including the laws that Congress has enacted to protect federal installations and federal personnel. So if the president didn't respond to what was happening in Portland, that would be an outrageous dereliction of duty, which I think would be akin to what's going on with the city and municipal and state governments in a lot of the blue states. But the president has a constitutional obligation to do what he's doing in Portland, which is to protect that facility. And in a, and to take that, Seb, when we see night after night that they're under siege and they're committing federal felonies left and right in front of everyone, and then conflate that with the other thing that the administration is trying to do, which is using the existing task force apparatus that you have between the federal law enforcement agencies like the FBI and DEA and the Marshal Service, to combine them with state police and city police, which goes on all the time, every day, in order to ramp up to deal with what's a big problem in America now, which is violent crime in the street, which is something else that they ought to be applauding being done, to not only condemn it, but to conflate it with the very different thing that's going on in Portland, is to me it's shameful. And they know better. It would bother me less if these were just stupid people who didn't know of what they spoke. They know exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, and to use language such as stormtroopers to describe these officers, these men of women, it's absolutely disgusting. As somebody who's dedicated a large chunk of your life before 9/11 and after 9/11 to making sure that New York is safe, I have to ask you, Andy, and please follow this man, read Ball of Collusion, read Willful Blindness. Your response to ideas such as $1 billion cut from the NYPD, the closing down of the anti-crime undercover unit, at a time like this, is this going to make things better?
You know, Seb, you would think that if crime were spiking month over month by close to 300%, you might think about adding $1 billion to the police budget. But the thought of cutting it at the very time that, that these guys are needed the most is just one indication, and it may not even be the most important one, of why things are disintegrating, which is because the city government and the political officials in New York, and New York is not the only big city that you can say this about, do not support the police. The police now have to worry that for doing their jobs, they will be prosecuted. We've seen police charged with assault crimes in order to try to take these tragic situations which have occurred around the country, which are the result very often of not necessarily police being overbearing, but of being provoked by people who are actually criminals. Police, in order to do their jobs, have to be able to use superior force. It's part of the gig. That's what they have to be able to do if they're going to keep the rule of law in place. And if the police now think that by doing policing, you can be charged with assault if something goes terribly wrong out there, they're obviously not going to take the chances and do the things that need to be done to keep cities secure. And now they, on the one hand, for doing their job, they have to worry about the potential of being charged criminally for it. And they're under assault. So that what's going on with these progressive governments in all of these cities is basically they are flashing the green light that it's open season on the police.
Yeah. The idea of
people are stunned that the crime rates have gone up.
The idea of how you put on that uniform, strap on that Sam Brown and that badge and that gun every day in these jurisdictions, it just boggles the mind how those men and women do it. Talk to us, if you will. You don't have a crystal ball, and 102 days is a lifetime in politics. But do you think this will be the issue? Will November 3rd be a law enforcement election in America?
I think that's the modern history of the country, Seb. You know, in 1968... Richard Nixon ran as the law and order candidate. In 1980, Ronald Reagan ran as the law and order candidate. And the atmosphere, particularly in 68, but this was as true in the late 70s as well, was that the country was coming undone by radicals and street criminals. And no matter what the press said, and no matter what the polls may have said, I can't say as I remember all that much about the polls at the time, except that Ronald Reagan was pretty far behind pretty late in the game and won spectacularly. People, if they're worried about leaving their homes, if they're worried about whether they can be safe on the streets of their neighborhood, that's an issue that hits home, and it's an issue they vote on.
Coming up.
And what President Trump has done, his spreading of racism, the way he deals with people based on the color of their skin, their national origin, where they're from, is absolutely sickening. No sitting president has ever done this. Never, never, never. No Republican president has done this. No Democratic president. We've had racists, and they've existed. They've tried to get elected president. He's the first one that has.
Joe Biden, when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As Americans struggle through this difficult time of unrest, there are very few parts of our country that avoided some level of scrutiny, past presidents included. While there have been great men who have run our country, many were slaveholders, and even some modern ones were overt racists, which makes Joe Biden's recent comment, which we played before the break, all the more curious. Here's Salem host Mike Gallagher.
I have, as a white Republican radio host, I have said my whole career, there is racism in America. But to throw it around and say, I disagree with somebody politically, and therefore I don't like your position in defending police, or I don't like your position supporting the military, or I don't like your position on taxes, or I don't, whatever the position is, to turn around and claim that somebody is a racist seems to me to be something you say when you run out of anything else to use in the argument. Joe Biden has gone there with Donald Trump. Mr. Biden has decided that the only way he can win is to go full-scale, scorched earth, radical, far-left terminology, ideology, and reflect the times. We're seeing a bunch of American cities resist law enforcement on the city or the state or the federal level. It doesn't matter what law enforcement you are. You could be a county sheriff or a member of the Secret Service or FBI. If you're in law enforcement, if you're a federal agent, if you are part of the effort to bring peace and lawfulness to a community, if you wear a badge, you are hated by a lot of people of a particular political party, and it's not the Republicans. Here's what Biden said. He was doing a virtual event. I don't know that people were shocked that he said it, maybe surprised, because there's an effort to present Vice President Biden as a moderate. There's an effort to say this is a nice guy who's right down the middle. There's nothing nice or down the middle about this.
And what President Trump has done in going his spreading of racism, the way he deals with people based on the color of their skin, their national origin, where they're from, is absolutely sickening. No sitting president has ever done this. Never, never, never. No Republican president has done this. No Democratic president. We've had racists, and they've existed. They've tried to get elected president. He's the first one that has.
The first American racist president, says Joe Biden.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubman and producers Charlie Richards, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey and Ben Brigman, as well as, of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.